A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
The dates are in full bloom, really, at this point.
That's Robert Wemishner. He's a professional baking instructor at LA Trade Tech.
Caramel, spice, citrus flavors, and they're amazing, and there are so many varieties.
Laura Avery caught up with him and his students at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
I think a lot of people don't realize that dates have a fresh stage, and then they continue to dry, and I think most people who grow up eating commercial dates are eating dried dates, just like dried figs are so different from fresh figs. We actually would consider these fresh dates right now.
That's right, and they have all the beautiful textures and, you know, smoothness and mouthfeel that's so appealing when they're eaten fresh, as you're saying. I love them.
And dates only come from one place in California, which is out in the desert, and we have three date farmers on Wednesday, and they all grow different varieties of dates.
That's what makes it so exciting to be at the market, because you can taste so many things, and educationally, of course, it's the best place for chefs in training to learn.
So have you decided what flavor profile of date you're going to select today?
Well, you know, I love the Kadrawi variety, which are sweet but have, you know, caramel notes and kind of a dark, dusky flavor to me that pairs beautifully with dairy as well. So what we'll do, I'm going to suggest that they roast them in the oven, pour some heavy cream over them, and let them kind of bubble up, and then scoop those up, take the pits out first if we want, and put it on a pastry that is flavored, inflected with lime. Kind of like a date shake on a plate, perhaps.
And what kind of pastry would that be? Would it be a flaky one or a spongy one or what?
It's going to be a sort of a dense, beautiful, buttery, shortbready texture. So it'll be kind of easy to bake it quick. You powder it up in the mixer or food processor, and then you carefully, lightly press it either on the sheet pan or in a mold. Bake it. We'll flavor it, as I say, with grated zest of lime.
Mm-hmm. And your class must be very popular.
We love to feed our campus at LA Trade Tech. You know, I mean, we're the most popular program, but we like to say that's because, you know, the food we produce and the sweets we produce are well enjoyed by the campus.
Yeah, and we love that you come here to source your ingredients.
It's exciting for the students and always exciting for me. I mean, the only way I get here on a Wednesday, because that's the day I teach, is to bring the students with me.
And you carpool.
And we carpool or take the train, the expo line, right from LA Trade Tech today, in fact.
Oh, yeah, that's fantastic. All right, so no reason not to come more often.
That's right. We will make it our business to be here as often as we can.
Okay, Robert. Well, thanks. That recipe just sounds great. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for your time.
That was Robert Wemishner. He is a professional baking instructor at LA Trade Tech College. He's out here with his whole class, and they are exploring the market today and really having a great time. We're now talking with Christina Kelso. She's one of our three date farmers who comes in from the Coachella Valley. Her farm is called Flying Disc. The other farmer who's also on the farm, Robert Lauer, is a Frisbee fanatic. So the farm is called Flying Disc. Christina, how would you advise somebody to pick the best date from your table?
Okay, to choose the perfect date. Well, one of my colleagues likes to say it's a little like dating people. It's like you got your classic date, like your dinner and a movie date would be your medjool. I mean, the barhi is like sexy date. Blondes love the barhi. I don't know. I think it's so individual. But I do think when you're looking at fruit, you can tell just by looking at it, you're drawn to certain ones. So most people, when they come to our table, I just say, like, which one is speaking to you? Or we'll start them with, you know, a few different samples. But yeah, I would go slow and try them all.
People think of dates as dried fruit, but actually at this time of year, the dates you're bringing in, they're fresh fruit, right?
They are.
So when you pick the dates, how do you do that?
It's actually a variety of ways. The variety of the date determines how. So we start with the barhis, the medjools, and the kadrawis. And the barhis are kind of fun because we just cut two bunches and pulley them down side by side. And each bunch, kind of like if you can picture a banana bunch, can weigh up to 80 or more pounds. And then we just clip those yellow barhis and sort the ripe ones. Something like the medjool, however, you have to go up and visit each bunch and shake it into a bucket, and the ripe ones fall. And then you close up that bunch, come down the ladder, and then you do that again two or three times over the course of two or three months, which is why the medjools are the most expensive. They're just extremely labor intensive.
How high are these trees?
Everything from maybe 12 feet to 20 feet.
How do you start a new date tree?
You can start a new tree from a seedling, just the seed, the date pit, but you're likely to get a male or a seedling that doesn't have all the qualities you want in a date. So we start them by harvesting the offshoots, which are an identical copy of their parent. So if you have a female medjool tree that's producing, the offshoot will be exactly like its mother.
So only the female trees produce fruit?
Correct, yes. And the male trees produce the pollen that pollinates the females. And it takes one male date palm to pollinate up to 50 female date palms. It's like a two-month process. So we harvest the pollen from the male date palm, and we kind of like hit the female blossoms over the head with it. And there's a cloud of pollen dust, and hopefully each little bead on that date palm gets pollinated. Otherwise, it won't become a date.
That must be your busiest time of year.
It is, but we're in the trees all the time. So, I mean, there's pollination, and then there's, you know, thinning, where we take out some of the dates, and then we have to tie them up so they don't tangle, and then we have to put bags on them. So we spend a lot of time in the trees and get to know them pretty well.
And you put bags on them, why?
In about July, we put them on, they're like a cheesecloth material, to keep the mice and birds out of them. When we put the bags on, they start turning these amazing colors, like salmon pink and orange and purple, and they're beautiful. Unfortunately, they have bags on them, so we can't really, the bags are a little bit opaque, so you can't really appreciate the colors. But once they go through that color change, then they start turning brown, like the familiar date color, brown or golden or amber colored. Mm-hmm.
So are they then ready to eat right then? Do they have to sit around or finish ripening, or are they just good to go?
They're good to go. Yeah, they're all tree ripened. So when we harvest them, we just pick them into the boxes and bring them to market. That's it.
And the dates that are all coming into the market now are fresh dates, and this is the best time of year to eat them, right?
Yeah.
That was Christina Kelso. She is a date farmer, and she brings in, about a dozen variety of dates here to the Wednesday Farmers Market year-round, except for 2 months in the summer. And you can stop by her booth and check out all these delicious dates. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Next, we talk about where to find truffles in LA. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
So it's a commodity and a parasite that adds $80 to any dish.
That's Los Angeles Magazine restaurant critic Patrick Q. He's talking about the highly sought-after fungi in season now, truffles. They're not cheap. 2 years ago, the world's largest white truffle went up for auction in New York. The 3.93-pounder sold in under a minute for $50,000 to a Taiwanese bidder, which was somewhat of a disappointment, actually, seeing as its predecessor sold the year before for over $400,000. Q says there are two varieties that chefs are working on to their menus now in L.A.
Essentially, within the food domain, it breaks down into white truffles, which are mostly associated with Italy. They're often called Alba truffles. And black truffles, which are slightly cheaper, and they're associated more with French cooking. They're called Périgord truffles for the region of France that a lot of them come from. There are truffles from other countries. There's Australian truffles, Croatian truffles. But those are essentially the two big demarcations. White truffles come in earlier, November-ish. You start seeing them on menus. Black truffles last slightly longer into the season. So we'll still be seeing black truffles until about end of February, sometime like that. It is a seasonal food. That's why it's so exciting when they finally arrive.
Are they used differently? In my mind, I tend to think of white truffles being used raw, mostly for their aromatics, and shaved, and then black truffles shaved, but also sometimes worked into dishes.
Yeah, you're exactly right. The white truffle shaved table side is one of the great moments. Incredibly perfumed, very aromatic, eaten raw over, just makes anything better. Usually something very modest. I mean, this is the beauty of truffles. When you pair them with modest things, a polenta, a pasta, that's the beauty of truffles. Black truffles, yes, they're great in sauces. They can also be shaved raw over anything. It takes the heat a bit better. It perfumes the sauce. There are many great sauces that involve truffles.
Okay, so let's talk about who's featuring them and how they're using them.
Right. You know, chefs get excited when truffles come in, and if their budget allows them, you know, let's not forget white truffles are going for about $3,000 a pound. Black truffles are going for about $800. So very expensive for any chef. All chefs, if they can get them, celebrate them. They just love what it does, that earthiness, that thing that nothing else could be that you smell from across the room. A great restaurant and one of sort of the charter restaurants for truffles is Patina. Every iteration of Patina, whether on Melrose or down by Disney Hall, celebrates truffles in a great way. And the current chef, Paul Lee, he's an interesting guy because, you know, he was born in Taiwan and he lived there until he was 11 and came to the United States and got the cooking bug at Cal State Fullerton. And, you know, I mean, it's wonderful to see somebody's story. They do the expensive version of truffles, and they also do the fairly economical one, which is exciting that you can get kind of affordable truffle dishes in LA at the moment. But let's go with the expensive one. The full-out white truffle menu is about $300, and it's on every course. You sort of get it calibrated toward the ingredient. That's the total
immersion
in truffles. And that is white truffle, the most expensive one, like scrambled eggs and truffles, that like just as an appetizer, a cold soup of sunchokes, yes, with a few finished truffles. I mean, it's a very delicate ingredient. He also does a great risotto. Creamy, buttery.
For me, that's like the perfect pairing.
Right. If you don't want the full menu, you can get the dish with a markup, you know, like a $65 markup for the dish. So Patina is really trying to
make it accessible
within the confines of what a truffle is. He also does a great bacon and cipollini onion tart with truffles
on
it. So the more rustic it is, the more it brings out in the truffle. Over in the Valley, there's a great place that's doing it, and talk about affordable. The Bellwether, it's Ted Hobson's restaurant. It's sort of between Sportsman's Lodge and Casa Vega there on Ventura Boulevard. And he does a $25 pasta dish, strozzapreti, you know, the kind of twisted pasta, a meat ragu, just heats the pasta with the meat ragu. And then he uses a microplaner, those long graters, and he just shaves it over the dish. And the microplaner, of course, shaves into very small, kind of powdery.
So it's almost like Parmesan.
It's almost like, it does put a bit of Parmesan on it also. But it's almost like Parmesan. You're exactly right. It's incorporated into the dish in a way that the slices aren't. It keeps that kind of sugo, rustic bowl of pasta feel. And you get that kick, you know, the truffle kick, and it costs $25.
That's incredible. Yeah. That's a good, like, truffle 101 experience.
Right, exactly. And then Wally's in Beverly Hills. I mean, this guy's a master of truffles, David Feo. He's really a French chef with great soul. He'll make a truffle butter from scraps of butter, and he'll heat lentils, and he'll just melt the truffle butter into the lentils, so you're getting the truffleness in a very simple dish of lentils. He also goes real, like, deep classic, and he'll slip some truffle slices underneath a chicken skin, roast it in a wood-fired oven, and then make one of the most classic of all sauces, sauce albufera, which, you know, comes from Escoffier or something. It's a deep reduction of chicken stock, like 10 gallons makes, you know, 2 liters. So it's naturally thickened. And then he'll just add a little bit of cream and heavy on the truffles, And that with the chicken is a fantastic dish.
And is that a black truffle dish or is that a white truffle?
He does that with black truffles, yeah, because it takes the sauce better. Yeah.
Wow, that sounds incredible.
Yeah.
While we're sort of waxing poetic about all of these local truffle dishes one can get, some people might be thinking, well, I can just make a pasta at home and throw in a little truffle oil or a little truffle salt. How can we disabuse them of this notion?
Okay. There are a few chefs that manage to use truffle oil and it works. Truffle oil is flavored synthetically. It has no truffle. What people do to preserve the real flavor of truffle is they store it in rice, or they store it with eggs so that that ingredient takes on that. But truffle oil does not have that. What I do like, though, and that I don't actually see it very often in L.A., is truffles can be canned so they can be enjoyed throughout the year. And that light brine that truffles are canned in, it can be spectacular. I've had a vinaigrette made out of that truffle brine, just over a minute of thin slices of turbot put under a salamander and a truffle vinaigrette, and it was spectacular. That is a great ingredient. Truffle oil, I don't know why chefs insist on using it. It's perfumey in the wrong way. It's like walking through the ground floor of a department store perfumey. You know, you're assaulted by it.
It has no finesse.
Yes.
It's a bait and switch because it's not teaching people what the actual beautiful thing that's so ephemeral is.
Yes. And given the price point that some of these chefs are working at, I mean, David Ferreau, he does a $27 appetizer. He makes a polenta. The scraps of truffles, of course, have as much flavor, so he can use all that. He stuffs tortellini in it, and he serves it with a grilled quail and just a little jus. That costs $27, and you're getting the real truffle flavor.
That's all you need to say. That's enough salesmanship.
Right.
Who else? Who else can we go visit?
Well, Josiah Citron at Melis is a master of truffles. You know, here in Santa Monica, he worked in Patina, so, you know, maybe there's a Patina thing there that I haven't traced fully. But Josiah is great with truffles, and he gets the tone of truffles, you know, the pitch that you can use it at. It doesn't have to be over the top. He might put a bit of white truffle over a bit of warm brie. He might make a foam and like put it over pasta with lobster bolognese. That contrast is everything. This is what truffle oil doesn't do. It overwhelms. It doesn't draw out. It doesn't contrast.
Are most Los Angeles-based restaurants getting their product from the Truffle Brothers, do you know?
A lot of them are getting it from the Truffle Brothers, but I think there's enough people out there who can secure it that there's a bit of competition on who's delivering to what restaurant. And I guess it keeps the price negotiable when there's competition. But yes, the Truffle Brothers are certainly one of the chief providers of truffles to the city's restaurants.
I love that they use dogs instead of pigs to hunt there.
Apparently getting the truffle away from a pig is... Yeah. You know, bring your gardening gloves or something. They don't just give it up.
Why do you think the price of truffles fluctuates so much?
Well, I guess it's a commodity, and there's 3 months in the year when every chef on earth wants one, whether they can afford it or not. And it's very peculiar because it's just this growth that attaches itself to the roots of trees, essentially a parasite. When it's found, as you say, by dogs or pigs that can smell them out, harvesting them doesn't harm the tree in any way.
And you know, like many natural things, it depends on the weather. And some years they're awash with them and some years are less.
Yeah, there's a whole life that the trees have. Many years when there's poor harvest, like if there's a sequence of them, it's followed by an incredibly abundant year. It's very hard to predict. Even the great, great connoisseurs of Alba and Perigord can't say, well, this year will be it. Apparently weather has heat doesn't have much to do with it. So it's not like grapes that you can say, oh, you know, this will be a good year or a bad year.
Moisture, though.
Moisture, apparently, yes.
Interesting. Is there fraud in truffles, as there is in so many high-end foodstuffs?
Is there fraud in truffles? I've never heard of fraud on the level of caviar, which is far trickier, because there you are talking about harvesting something that can deplete a species. And there are methods of harvesting caviar that don't harm the fish. the main harvest is in the Caspian, that shares borders with several countries, and it can become very murky. I wouldn't want to accuse anybody of doing anything nefarious, but in truffles, you know, the truffle is there. It has been found. It's very hard to fake what a truffle is. You can smell it the moment it's in the room. Patina, in fact, celebrates it by putting it in a special box by the entrance. I personally haven't heard of great underhanded behavior.
Los Angeles Magazine restaurant critic Patrick Q, he is such a wealth of information, isn't he? And I just have to say, I know it's kind of weird we're talking about truffles, especially after this week. However, they are a seasonal product, and we do want to support our local restaurants, and you'll be seeing them around. In a minute, it's time to talk Thanksgiving. And we're not just talking turkey and sweet potatoes. Don't turn that dial.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. America's biggest holiday devoted to eating is, of course, Thanksgiving. It goes down next week, so we invited two of our favorite gals to talk about what they'll be serving this year. Amanda Hesser and Meryl Stubbs are the founders of Food 52. They have a cookbook called Food 52, A New Way to Dinner, a playbook of recipes and strategies for the week ahead. Hi, Amanda.
Hi.
Hi, Meryl.
Hi.
Let's start with size. Size matters when it comes to a turkey. How big should we get depending upon our number of guests?
I tend to be a small turkey fan, no matter how many guests. I'd rather do multiple turkeys than have one giant turkey. Are you the same, Meryl?
I have never had a huge group, so I've always tended to buy small turkeys just out of necessity. But yes, I agree with you. I think if I were to have a large group, I'd probably buy two smaller turkeys rather than one large one. For time reasons, obviously, just for like oven jockeying, but also tenderness and taste.
Yeah. I think when a turkey breast gets too large, I get kind of grossed out. I'm just,
well
just saying. But in terms of like meat per pound or meat per pound,
pound
per person, it's funny because we have like a daily Thanksgiving newsletter that we send out for helping people prep. And one of the things was exactly like how much food to plan per person. And we said a pound and a half of turkey. We had prefaced it by saying, you know, we're going to tell you a little bit too much of certain things because we know that everyone loves leftovers. And people kind of wrote in,
crazy.
They were like, a pound and a half? That's crazy. And, you know, fair enough. Like, no one's going to sit down and eat a pound and a half of turkey. And also,
well,
it's a pound and a half. That's with the bone. So it's not even a pound and a half. But even, let's just say, a pound or even 3/4 of a pound, you're probably not going to eat it on Thanksgiving because you're having so many other things. But you are going to want to eat that the next day and over the weekend.
Definitely. I mean, for me, anything less than a pound per person is just, why bother?
Yeah. Right. It's a lot of work.
It is
a lot
of work.
Have lots of extras.
Can you get in there on the comment section, please?
Support
okay,
us.
Okay, I will. I'll support you. Also, are you a slavish proponent of the whole bird for that Norman Rockwell moment? Or do you think that there are techniques and times when parts are more useful?
Well, I think that Amanda sort of got at a belief we share, which when she was talking about extra large breasts, which I think also hints at the fact that we're more dark meat fans than
yes.
White meat in general. For that reason, I tend to go for a whole bird because it's much easier to find a whole breast on its own if you're looking for parts than it is to find like turkey legs.
Yeah. And can I confess that I don't always serve turkey?
Yes, please
do. I love,
do.
We're getting deep and dark already.
Well, once I did a guinea hen, which I felt like was kind of a nod in the direction of a turkey, but with a flavor that I preferred, and so did my family. And then I did shellfish, which supposedly is what was eaten on Thanksgiving Day. I never looked back.
Yeah, Amanda actually created her ideal Thanksgiving menu using our Thanksgiving menu genie on the site, which we put out this year, and it doesn't have turkey on
it. Porchetta.
Yeah.
What is the genie? Explain that to me.
Well, we love the genie.
We love the genie. So it's basically a quiz tool that prompts you for every course or dish type of your meal with different categories. If it's the turkey, for example, or the main event, you have five or six choices. One is, do you like your turkey sort of classic, old school? Another one is like turkey with a twist. Another version is something vegetarian. Another is meat that's not a turkey. And there are multiple choices for each one of those selections. So you basically get to go through and choose from all of our best recipes for every aspect of your meal. Then it saves it for you. And you can print it, you can email it, you can save it to your profile page on the site. And share it on social.
It's like figuring out your fashion style.
It's very much like that. I was going to say, it gets into the sort of personality of your Thanksgiving as opposed to just the categories, and also the kind of sort of attitudes and challenges that everyone has, like with various family members who don't always agree on flavor combinations or what needs to be on the table. And so it kind of allows you to check all those boxes and do it in a way that's fun and comprehensive and actually very useful.
Yeah, and it's very flexible. So you can just leave out things completely. We have bread as one of the options, and you can basically say, I'd never bake bread.
Yeah.
I would never even consider it. Or choose three different orange vegetable sides.
I love that, orange vegetable sides. Okay.
I mean, there's so many good orange vegetable sides out there.
Isn't that strange? It's so funny. It's probably the only time of the year that we think about that in terms of color.
Yeah.
Going back to the bird just for a second, are you two or either of you proponents about brining or not brining? And do you feel, would you rather see a wet rub or a dry rub?
Passionate about dry brining.
Same.
That's, yeah, I think we both are.
Not only dry brining, but then leaving it uncovered in the fridge, which we also do with chickens as well on a regular basis, which dries out the skin and helps it become more crisp in the oven.
Yeah, I think in terms of just brining in general, we just both feel that the flavor is far superior if you salt the bird ahead of time. And then in terms of texture, I think that the texture of a dry brine bird is far superior to a wet brine, which gets very kind of rubbery and kind of commercial tasting, whereas a dry brine bird is just juicy and tastes like turkey.
Do you find these days that when home cooks are approaching holidays like Thanksgiving, they're still going to that super rich kind of chef-y paradigm? Or do you think people are paring things back and trying to do things really tasty, but maybe simpler in some way?
I think the latter. I mean, I think it's just an overall trend. Thanksgiving is no exception. I think there's sort of some nostalgia that's part of that. You said Norman Rockwell a few minutes ago, and I think that there's something that resonates for people about sort of hearkening back to a simpler time, but doing it really well, unfussy, uncomplicated, but the best version of what it can be. I think that's sort of a theme.
I do think that the other thing you're seeing more on the Thanksgiving table is just more greens.
And specifically not cooked greens, I think, too.
Yeah.
Fresh greens, kale.
As a child, I always insisted that there be a salad at Thanksgiving because we never had dinner without a salad. And everybody used to think that I was insane. They made me make it because nobody wanted to commit. But every year, it always got eaten.
That's so interesting. So, you were so ahead of your time.
Yeah. What went into your Thanksgiving salad?
It's really just about the dressing. So it's just a really good lettuce-based salad. You know, a lot of very crisp things to play off the richness and lack of texture of much of the rest of the meal. But then it always had this very sharp red wine vinegar-based garlic parmesan dressing.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My mom made it every day of my life.
A great foil, right, to everything.
Yeah, you need to have it. Is there any way to save an overcooked or an underbrowned bird?
Sure. I mean, you literally could pull off the skin and just stick it under the broiler.
You could, absolutely.
And then just put it back on.
Yeah.
I mean,
like you would do with, you know, a pinch out on a porchetta or something.
Yeah. And I mean, no one's going to know because you're going to carve the turkey anyhow. And that could be a very reasonable way to save a turkey. I think an overcooked one, I would slice and like layer into the gravy before serving. You know what I mean? So it's almost like soaking in the gravy, which, you know, again, is not like an unusual thing. Chefs do that with lots of meats. They'll cook them, slice them, and then immerse them.
Bathe
them in their juices or whatever kind of sauce.
Whenever, you do that anyway.
I mean, we do that. Yeah, like when we slice turkey, we're always going to pour over a little bit. Certainly the juices and if not some of the gravy, kind of keep it moist even on its way to the table.
I think you should share your philosophy actually about when the turkey comes out of the oven relative to sitting down.
Oh, right. Because I think that one of the things that really freaks people out is getting everything done on time, especially when you only have one oven. You know, a good reminder is just that, like, when you go to a restaurant, especially, like, better restaurants, The food is almost never served hot. It's, it might be served warm, but a lot of things are even kind of nearing room temperature. And with turkey, I always think it's a great idea to get it cooked, take it out, let it rest, because you can always rewarm it in its juices once you've carved it, or just use the hot gravy to kind of warm it up. You could warm your plates mm-hmm. by putting on the back of your stove, which is what I often do when I'm cooking, because the sort of residual heat from the other things that are cooking will warm your plates. It's one of those things that I completely understand why people get concerned about. But if you take that big worry out of the equation, it makes kind of getting the rest of the food done on time easier.
Yeah. I mean, there is nothing more stressful than trying to carve a turkey while you're also babysitting like three pots
yes.
on the stove, you know, reheating your mashed potatoes and your gravy and making sure everything's
yes.
hot and carving in between. I mean, it's like...
And it's actually really hard to carve a turkey when it's very hot.
Yeah.
Because it's like you can't touch it. You burn your fingers. And you kind of really need to like sometimes hold the bird with your hand as you're carving. And actually, I don't think it cuts as cleanly.
I think what people should do is take a picture of the bird when it first comes out of the oven. Share it with everyone's phone so they can see what the beautiful bird looked like. Then break it down hours before, carve it up, and bring it to the table already sliced.
Well, that's a great idea, actually, like getting it done first and breaking it down like mm-hmm. before so that you can kind of clean up a bit before you get...
Yeah, it's such a mess after you carve a turkey.
Yes, it makes a giant mess.
I have to ask you, since you talked about the orange vegetables, give me a rundown.
My all-time favorite orange vegetable side that I make every single year, and it's very popular among everyone who works at Food 52 as well, is Amanda's butternut squash puree, which is made by chopping up butternut squash into chunks and throwing it in a pot with lots of olive oil and covering it and cooking the crap out of it, really.
the most accurate description.
And then you add a little bit of cream at the end, or you don't have to, but you can. I don't know. It's this miraculous, super simple technique that the flavors are just always really pronounced. I think maybe because of the high heat where you're sort of getting some caramelization.
And then the oil kind of gets almost sort of like
infused.
Emulsified somehow with the butternut. So that technique, I just sort of adapted from an Alice Waters recipe for fennel. Where you slice fennel and you cook it over a pretty quite high heat with a lot of olive oil. If there are carrots, I like them with a kind of Moroccan sort of lemony spiced situation. It's a nice contrast to the bird and to the sort of maybe other more starchy sides. I think that like anytime you can kind of take the kind of starchier elements of Thanksgiving, and I'm not saying I love a good buttery, creamy mashed potato, but you can at least give the illusion of lightness or brightness. I think it's good to take advantage of that. I'm not a huge sweet potato fan. I feel like such a Debbie Downer on Thanksgiving. No turkey, no sweet potatoes. But on sweet potatoes, I'm trying to remember whose recipe this was, but I wrote about it a long time ago, and it was, I believe it was a chef, and they made like a lemon syrup and poured it over the sweet potatoes before roasting them. Because then of course, the sugars kind of help extra caramelize the potatoes, but also the lemon becomes kind of, it's a very fragrant effect on the lemon, but also you get the nice acidity. Mm-hmm. I always liked that recipe.
I love sweet potatoes, but I do not like to add more sweetness to them. The only way I like them is by adding a pretty strongly savory component. I make a lot of meat sauce over the winter. My kids are like enthusiastic carnivores. Instead of having it over pasta, I'll have it over a baked sweet potato because I love the play of the savory, the meat, and the acid all together. And of course, some Parmesan on top. But I also love at Thanksgiving in particular, this is actually something I think I learned from Marcus Samuelson. Mash sweet potatoes with creme fraiche and salt and pepper and lots of herbs.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, I love that.
One more sweet potato recipe that I really like, which is actually comes from Nora Ephron. It's like potatoes Anna, which are like little round discs of potatoes that you layer in a kind of cake-like form. But she did it with sweet potatoes, brown butter, and prunes. Mm. I mean,
that one's good.
I think brandy, too. I think there was some brandy in there. You kind of can't go wrong.
That's on the site.
That is,
and I just have to jump in here, too. I think what I've started doing lately...
Join the sweet potato party.
Yeah, is buying the really small sweet potatoes and roasting them in their jackets like you would a russet, and then serving them with a very sharp lime butter and cilantro. Mm. Well, I think we're getting ready to actually eat.
Excellent. We're ready.
We're definitely ready.
Thank you so much.
Where do we sit? Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Amanda Hesser and Meryl Stubbs are the founders of Food 52. Find a link to their Thanksgiving menu genie, what a concept, along with recipes for some of the Thanksgiving dishes we discussed on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
You know, Julia Child had recipes that went on for 6 pages. I'd look at that and just think, that's just ridiculous. I don't have to do all those things.
That's Mark Bittman. His new cookbook is How to Bake Everything. It's been 18 years since his book, How to Cook Everything, hit the stands. So I asked him, have baking and cooking become easier or more difficult?
You know, I have to think it's become easier, but it's really a question of whether people know how to do it or not. Certainly there's more information, and if you're the type of person who likes to learn from videos or the web or your phone, all of those things are available, and they weren't 20 years ago, so there's that. But, you know, fabulous as my cookbooks are, or as we like to think they are, there were cookbooks 20 years ago.
Yeah, but I get this feeling that finally people are cooking more after having cooked less for a very long time.
I also have the feeling that there's an uptick and that it's better than it was 10 years ago, for sure.
How important was it in this book for you to represent so many different baking traditions?
You know, when I started, it was an eagerness to get beyond French cooking, which was pretty much all anyone was interested in. And then it was a curiosity about non-European cooking. And that's just who I became as a cook. And that continues here. Every culture that's built fires, which is every culture that cooks, has baking traditions. And there's no reason to favor one over another. They're all pretty interesting. Some get a little ridiculous and some are hyper simple. But the solid majority of places in the world have at least a few interesting things to bake.
Could you give us a taste of a couple of the more unknown dishes that you'd like home bakers to embrace?
I like flatbreads. They're quick. They're generally easy. Speaking of improvisation, you can sort of combine any flour with water and roll it out and turn it into a flatbread. You mentioned nanira at the beginning, which is the Ethiopian bread made from teff. So that's something a lot of people have not tackled at home. I also like the Afghan snowshoe naan, which are sort of halfway between focaccia and regular naan and shaped, as you would imagine, like a snowshoe. So those are kind of cool. But, you know, the most familiar stuff in here is this sort of traditional American desserts, which people know and many people know how to make already. So they're just my take on classics. But the breads and the desserts from elsewhere are, I think, mostly new to most people. I don't know. When I started researching this, which was 5 years ago, there was a lot of stuff that was new to me. I do remember this time I was in Turkey and I was served what amounted to cherries on toast for dessert. And I thought, God, that's just an incredible thing. But, you know, if you have toast that's like brioche and you have really great cherries cooked a little bit, you think about it, it's not unlike, I don't know what, pound cake with strawberries on it.
So because of the way you tend to look at a recipe as something really as a utilitarian place to start, and your mind tends to explode with possibilities, I thought that an interesting way to highlight the breadth of the material in the book would be through one ingredient. And that ingredient, I will admit I have some bias for, which is ricotta, which I really love.
Right.
I looked at the index, and there have to be at least 30 recipes that have it. So could you sort of talk a little bit about what ricotta brings to a recipe and how you manage to use it so variously?
If you think about what ricotta is, it's curdled milk, and it's among the freshest cheeses and the most milk-like of cheeses. And when you think how wide a range milk has in baking, it's not surprising that ricotta does also. But what it brings that milk doesn't, of course, is a little extra texture and, I think I can say, increased sweetness. So when you make ricotta cake or cheesecake or some interesting fritters in here with beans and ricotta, you get more creaminess than you're going to get from milk and a little more texture. And as I said, a bit more sweetness. And the stuff people are familiar with besides ricotta cheesecake are like spinach cheese triangles. Ricotta has a big role in there. I do some palmier with ricotta and a couple other cheeses. It's really nice. Pizza, of course, with ricotta on it. You know, I think that characteristic of having texture and sweetness that goes beyond milk is what gives a little extra something to whatever you're baking with it. Yeah, I guess it's not that complicated.
Not that complicated, but I doubt that there are many people who use it as thoroughly as you do.
I'm looking at the index, and I think of these. This chocolate pound cake with ricotta and orange is really great. And then these various fritters. So I mentioned the bean fritters, but there are dried tomato fritters and sweet fritters, two peach, pears, etc. All have ricotta in them. And those are fantastic. Fritters are, I mean, we could look in the index and see how many fritters there are in this book. It's probably 30 of those also, but justifiably.
And it's such an easy thing for people to make.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that people think are hard and then they wind up, you know, I'm sure you remember, as I do, the first time you made pâte à choux and that whole thing of stirring the eggs in one at a time off the heat where, you know, your arms get this real workout. And then suddenly you have this amazing dough that you can do a million different things with, from gougère to éclair to vol-au-vent. I mean, all this stuff. And it's like before you make something like that, you're intimidated by it because even the name is weird and you're not quite sure what it is and you don't know what's going to happen, but it just comes together so easily. And, you know, that's true of many things in baking that intimidate people. I still have conversations every day now with people who say, oh, I've always wanted to make bread, but I'm afraid of it. And bread, you know, as you know, is not a scary thing to make once you start. And then there are things that are, I don't know if they're justifiably intimidating, but they take time and they take care, like puff pastry, which turns out to be, you know, it's not a no-brainer. It's not something you'd invent by yourself. But once someone walks you through it, it's not that difficult. And the next thing you know, you can make croissants that are like the best croissants you ever had in your life. So, yeah, I think that the overall thing is to show the connections among recipes, as usual, to show that some few techniques can lead to many wonderful results, and to show that, you know, if you can make pasta with tomato sauce, you can pretty much make anything else. I mean, if you're willing to get in front of the stove, you know, it's going to work.
You've included 90 last-minute recipes in your book that take half an hour each or less to complete. What are some of your favorites?
Probably 10% of the book are relatively fast recipes. Well, I mentioned fritters, and they're all in here, of course, and all kinds of fried dough things. Biscuits, olive oil cookies, really awesome. Many, many cookies, peanut butter cookies, oatmeal raisin, don't take long. And then some complicated stuff too, or not complicated, but the kinds of things that many people would not think of, like financier, which is a, you know, sort of a fancy dessert, pretty quick to put together. Granola, granola bars, cheese straws, which are like among my most favorite things.
And crackers. You have a whole chapter on crackers.
Yeah. Well, you know, you take some dough, you roll it thin, you bake it slowly, you're done. It's not that big a deal. It's just none of us have ever done it. And we all grew up eating crackers. And I'd be surprised if 1% of the population of the United States grew up knowing how to make a cracker. So here it is.
What else?
Matzah, of course, which I did that as a video when I was doing the minimalist column, which is kind of funny because my matzah has olive oil in it, which is a sacrilege on many levels, but it's really much better than regular matzah.
Probably the original matzah was made with olive oil.
No, because the original matzah was like, wasn't it, they fled without anything, so all they had was flour. They didn't have any olive oil with them.
I know, it was flour water. I'm sorry.
And pancakes, which everybody's like, you know, I shouldn't degrade...
Belittle people's love of pancakes?
Yeah, or belittle... I'm really belittling my own ability to do anything, but people all the time come up to me and say, oh, your pancake recipe is amazing. And really, my basic pancake recipe is the basic pancake recipe. It's no more nor less amazing than anyone else's, but... happily, many people have learned it from me, so I'm grateful for that. But this list has probably 8 pancake recipes on it, and they're, needless to say, they're all fast.
Well, I just want to thank you for giving everyone another reason to embrace the carbohydrate.
Yeah, well, there is that. And I want to thank you for not asking me the dread gluten question.
Oh, no. Mark Bittman's new book is How to Bake Everything. Find a recipe for his cheese straws on the Good Food blog. Next, we hear about something savory to start off the Thanksgiving meal. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country, put your old ride to good use, and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
I have fallen in love with savory cookies, and I would like to be the savory cookie evangelist.
That's Dory Greenspan. She has a new cookbook called Dory's Cookies.
And certainly for Thanksgiving, it's so great to have something small that you can just nibble on that's surprising.
Well, I like surprising for Thanksgiving because, you know, there aren't a lot of surprises usually.
Not in my Thanksgiving. There weren't as a child. Now as an adult, we can make surprises. But a cookie like the rosemary parmesan cookie. It's shortbread cookie, but very flaky. I chop the rosemary, and there's a little bit of sugar in the cookie, and I mash the sugar and the rosemary together so you get great flavor. That's a wonderful cookie. It's great with sparkling wine. It's great with white wine. It's a sophisticated cookie. It's not a kid's cookie necessarily. And I think it would be so nice to start a meal with that. Sesame sea salt, another good cookie. I've made some savory cookies that have been a little bit more complicated, but I think for Thanksgiving, something small, something with a lot of flavor, so that you're not going to eat many of them. You're just going to get a mouthful of great, great flavor. Perfect for the holidays.
I know you think you're not going to be hungry for something before you start your Thanksgiving dinner, but trust me, you will. And that rosemary parmesan shortbread or her sesame sea salt cookies, they sound like they might fit the bill. Find recipes on the Good Food blog. I would be remiss if I didn't mention booze in a conversation about Thanksgiving. What about sherry with turkey?
Absolutely fantastic with turkey. I would go with either an Amontillado or an Oloroso chilled with your turkey. It will go with all the sides too, because it's robust enough to take those other flavors. And I know you always have lots of different sides on your Thanksgiving table. I think this Thanksgiving, give sherry a go.
That's Kay Plunkett Hogg. She has a new book called A Sherry and a Little Plate of Tapas. Tune in next week to hear my full conversation with her.
So Pinoy Thanksgiving, it looks a lot like a traditional Thanksgiving meal, but also a huge Filipino meal.
That's Chef Isa Fabro. She makes pastries and sells them at Unit 120 in LA's Far East Plaza in Chinatown.
So when you go and have Pinoy Thanksgiving, you're really having two huge feasts put together. The table will have all the American favorites of roast turkey, green bean casserole, sweet potatoes, pumpkin pie. And in that mix, there will also be lechon pancit, lumpia, a variety of sweets called kakanin. It's an umbrella term for different kinds of festive rice cakes. And depending on the family or the region, there are certain specialties that are brought out. It's just a hit-you-in-the-face kind of feast.
I don't even know what I would do if I had those two parallel cuisines staring at me in the face.
Well, whenever if you're invited to a Filipino home for any kind of feast, you're expected to eat at least four or five plates, big plates. So you kind of maybe start off with a traditional American plate, and then you have your second plate of Filipino food, and then maybe you mix it up and you have,
you know, go back for your favorites.
Yeah, Filipino spaghetti, and then you have a piece of pie on the same plate. And then you just kind of keep going, and then somebody's always asking you, hey, are you eating? Eat some more. Eat some more. And that's how it goes on for a couple of hours.
So let's talk about the spaghetti, since you mentioned it.
So Filipino spaghetti, it is spaghetti, so the pasta spaghetti. But the sauce, it's not the kind of Italian-American tomato sauce that you think of as spaghetti. It's more like a banana ketchup or a very sweet tomato sauce, even like regular ketchup. And then it has cut up hot dogs. And it's a favorite amongst kids. Like, kids' parties will always have that. I didn't actually grow up eating that. It was something that I first experienced when I was already an adult. It's not something that I eat too much, but I see the nostalgia.
That sounds completely like a military base situation.
Yeah. I'm sure that it has something to do with the American influence, like Spam. And that's, not just in Filipino culture, but just anywhere that has like a military presence, Korea, Japan. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, Hawaii especially.
When you see a sweet potato or a yam pie on a Filipino Thanksgiving table, is it going to be tweaked a little bit or is it going to be straight up American?
Sometimes you'll see it roasted. I'm actually doing a pie for Thanksgiving, and it's kind of like a twist on a sweet potato slash pecan pie, and it's actually an ube pilina pie. It's kind of like how I said American and Filipino food together on one table. This is a pie that kind of combines those ideas in a pie.
Describe what ube is.
Ube is a purple yam, and it's really common in a lot of Filipino desserts. I've used it in a few of the things that I've sold at Unit 120. So this is kind of like, if you're going to think of it like sweet potato in the pie, so like almost like a custard, but still a little bit dense and a deep, sweet flavor. And then pili nut is a nut that's native to the Philippines. It's a tree nut. It's kind of like a toffee that I've made to put on the top of that. And it has a flavor that is like a cross between a Brazil nut and a pine nut. But it's nice and toasty. It has a nice crunch. And then the crust that I do is a vodka crust. So,
oh, that's very interesting that you do a vodka crust.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because when you brought us one of these pies, and thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And I was looking at it, and it looked like a chocolate pecan pie. It's very dark in color.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the filling, I'm using a muscovado sugar. So that's going to have a darker color as it's baking. Yeah, it's not going to have that bright purple. It's because it's baked. You know, the color is going to change. I don't use any food coloring in any of the pastries I make unless it's something that I feel should have that if I'm making a birthday cake. So this is like a very natural, straightforward pie.
Watch our video of Chef Isa Fabro making her signature isomata pastries. They are so good. The video's on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. If you're interested in ordering Isa's ube and pili nut pie, go to our website for ordering instructions.
There'll be herb salad with this swirl of fried sweet potato that looks like whatever's on top of Don King's head.
That's our favorite food critic, Jonathan Gold. He's talking about greens and sweet potatoes. But it's not the traditional Thanksgiving fare that's on his plate. He's eating at Tempura Endo this week in Beverly Hills. They specialize in Kyoto-style tempura.
tempura, which is, you know, roughly speaking, Japanese fry food, is super popular, but there's an exalted form of it that doesn't appear very often here at all. And I think this is probably the only, like, super high-end tempura restaurant on the West Coast at the moment.
So when you say super high-end, give us an idea of what a meal costs here.
There's different levels of omakase, and unless you come really late at night when they change their menu a little bit, you have to get it omakase or a set menu, and they range between 150 on the low end to 280 on the top end.
Given that it's omakase, is it set up like a sushi bar? Are you sitting in front of the chef who is frying your foods?
There are a few tables, but yeah, you are sitting in front of the chef. Instead of standing behind a counter of fish, he's standing behind this giant hammered metal thing behind which is boiling oil in which he will be frying almost all of your dinner.
Wow. Okay, so take us through what you had and what was particularly interesting.
Okay, you start by ordering sake. I think sake is like the way to go. The beer is much, much cheaper. The signature dish at the restaurant, which has been operating in Kyoto for more than a century, is corn.
Seriously, corn?
Yeah, it's a sweet Japanese corn. I don't know if they get it here or import it. And they cut it into sort of a fillet off the cob, and it sticks together. And they put it in this delicate batter, and they fry it. And there's a slight bit of oiliness. There's that crispness, and then there's the separate pop, pop, pop of the corn kernels bursting in your mouth. It's really good.
Wow.
You wouldn't think corn would be a big deal, but it's sort of like a caviar-like experience. I mean, the way that you get the popping under your teeth.
So that sort of gets your attention in a big way.
Yeah. After the corn, there's a live Santa Barbara spot prawn when they can't get what they consider the much better shrimp from Japan. It's really good fried shrimp.
So it's not live while you're eating it. It's just the freshest it could be.
The freshest it could be. And like, in a way, I'm happy it's not live when it goes into the oil. It's not super crunchy. It's like still a little bit pale. And you can taste the little cells of the shrimp bursting under your teeth. Again, the whole thing of like texture. It's nice. And, you know, when you're done with that, they give you the deep fried head. Do you eat shrimp heads?
Yeah, I love shrimp heads.
Shrimp heads are really good. That may be the highlight of the meal. I mean, there's Santa Barbara uni wrapped in seaweed and maybe cooked a little bit too long. I tend to like uni raw rather than cooked. One of their very big deal things, which a fat Japanese sea scallop, which is split in half and stuffed with Ocetra caviar and then fried, is maybe overkill. I mean, you wish that it had been like a couple seconds less in the oil. And the caviar, I'm sure, is wonderful on its own, but
they're going for what would say would be a super luxury experience.
A super luxury experience. After you're done, they bring out the tendon, which is one of my favorite dishes. It's like mixed tempura with, you know, shrimp and fish and vegetables and things that they put on rice and they slightly moisten. And it's not only better than the one in Hanasuke, which is one of my favorite things to eat in L.A., but it's like so much better than Hanasuke that it's almost a different creature. So they're operating on a really high level.
But you can't just go there and order that bowl.
You can't just go there and order that bowl. Thinking about the expense, frankly, when you go out of there and your bill with tax and tip and the lowest end sake ends up being, you know, $600, it's...
For how many people?
Two. That's expensive. The original restaurant in Kyoto is about half the price. And they don't have the caviar, and they don't have truffles, and they don't have deep-fried A5 Miyazaki beef. You know, A5 Miyazaki Japanese beef is some of the best beef in the world, and you might not want to deep-fry it if you get hold of some.
Thank you so much.
So glad to be here.
That's Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Tempura Endo in Beverly Hills. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. That is it for this week's show.
You can listen to any of the segments at kcrw.com or on KCRW's mobile app. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. That is
Abby Fentress Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine, Camellia Say,
Joel Stein,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food. Don't be afraid of Thanksgiving. You can do it. One more thing, we've got a special Thanksgiving show for you. So if you need background noise while you're cooking, tune into KCRW on Thursday at 1 p.m. and at 7 p.m. to hear our show.